This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We all know that your sex is determined by the X and Y chromosomes you inherit from your parents. But there is also a process of sex differentiation in the brain called brain masculinization. Scientists are figuring out just how that works. And in doing so, they have made some surprising discoveries. Researchers writing in the journal Nature Medicine report that aspirin and other similar pain relievers taken during pregnancy could affect the chemicals that are responsible for brain masculinization in the newborn, causing low sex drive later in life. And while the studies were done on laboratory rats, it does raise the question about humans. Could a similar thing be happening in people? Moms who take aspirin during pregnancy, could they be decreasing their son's sex drive? Or as one commentator put it, could there be men around the country, some husband out there saying, "Sorry, dear, not tonight. My mother had a headache 30 years ago." That's what we'll be talking about first up this hour, brains, drugs, and sex. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guest. Margaret McCarthy is a professor in the Department of Physiology and the program in neuroscience at the University of Maryland in Baltimore. Dr. McCarthy joins us by her phone from there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
We don't normally think about the brain and hormones influencing brain development and masculinization. Can you give us the ABCs of this, what's happening up there and what you're trying to find out?
Well, it's actually something that we've known about for close to 50 years, that the brain starts out life as being sort of neutral or bipotential, and then depending on what hormones it's exposed to in utero, it's going to determine if that brain's going to be a male brain versus a female brain. So we've known this for a very long time, but what we haven't known is what the steroid hormones are doing. The normal course of events is that the male fetus, as it's developing, first, as you said, his sex is determined by his chromosomes. His chromosomes then determine if he's going to have testes or not. Once he's got testes, they're going to make testosterone, and then the testosterone is going to make sure that the brain sex is going to match the gonadal sex.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we are trying to do is find out how are steroids having this effect on the brain.
And what did you discover in these laboratory animals?
Well, so what we discovered was surprising, as you said. We've known this for a very long time. We haven't known how it's happening, not because we haven't been trying, but because we've been spending our time looking at the usual suspects. We focused on growth factors and neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin and things, never thinking that an unexpected molecule like a prostaglandin could be having such an effect. Prostaglandins are part of a broad class of compounds found throughout the body that have a variety of effects. They're implicated in inflammatory responses, fever, pain, the contractions associated with labor, wound healing, bone growth, a whole variety of things. But they had not previously been implicated in brain development, and much less in a very specific type of brain development that occurs in one brain region in one sex. So what we found is that the testosterone that the male normally produces, the effect that it's having is to make more prostaglandin in one part of his brain that's going to determine that when as an adult he's going to express male sex behavior.
And you mean the urge to have sex? Is that what male sex behavior is?
Well, that would be a way of putting it, yeah. So that when he's presented with a sexually receptive female or when in the wild he naturally encounters one, goes looking for one, that he will then attempt to copulate with the female. So what we found is that in males in which we blocked this prostaglandin synthesis from occurring, when they encountered a sexually receptive female, they didn't try to copulate with her. They were interested in her in terms of, like, socially. They sort of groomed the female and interacted with her, but they didn't try to have sex with her.
And then you further experiment found that that aspirin given during this pregnancy has the same effect.
Yeah, so aspirin is a well-known prostaglandin synthesis inhibitor, and so we wanted to give a treatment that would be more clinically relevant. So we exposed the males to the aspirin via their mothers by putting it in their drinking water during the last week of pregnancy and the first week of lactation. Now, it had a much milder effect, probably because we gave a very low dose of aspirin that had a much milder inhibition of the prostaglandin synthesis.
Mm-hmm. And what happened when you gave it to females?
Nothing. And that's because the females normally don't have this high level of prostaglandins, and so there's nothing there to inhibit. But what we did do then was we provided the females with prostaglandins to see what would happen. So we'd already known that if we take a newborn female rat pup and give her testosterone, you can give her just one single injection early in her life, raise her to adulthood, and experimentally ask, will you show male sex behavior? The answer is yes. It has to be early testosterone exposure, only during what we call a sensitive window. It's just a brief developmental period. What we did now was we gave, instead of testosterone, we gave the prostaglandin, mm-hmm. and it had the exact same effect as the testosterone.
Mm-hmm. And when you gave the aspirin, was it in doses that, you know, might be taken, you know, normal size, or did you do a, you know, very high laboratory dose?
Oh, no. It was we gave one baby aspirin a day into the drinking bottle of the drinking water of the female rat, and they drank about half the bottle. So mm-hmm. it was a very, you know, it's not a pharmacological dose.
Right.
We monitored a variety of endpoints to assure that we hadn't given high doses, because high doses of aspirin have well-known teratological effects, and none were observed.
So let's talk about the elephant that's in the room now. The applications for people and pregnant women.
Uh-huh.
What are they?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. You don't want to over-extrapolate from a single study in rats to something as complex as humans. It's complicated further by the distance between the event and the cause. You know, if a man goes to the doctor and asks for a prescription for Viagra, he's not going to ask him, did your mom take aspirin when she was pregnant? You know, so there's a 30, 40, 50-year gap between exposure and outcome, which does illustrate the point that prenatal programming can have all sorts of influences that we don't know about yet.
Mm-hmm.
Aspirin is already contraindicated during pregnancy for women. Most of these prostaglandin synthesis inhibitors are. However, in some instances, women are encouraged to take them because of life-threatening conditions such as preeclampsia, which is life-threatening high blood pressure, or due to premature labor, which is also life-threatening. Those women, you know, should continue to do what they have to do during those dire circumstances. But what we might want to think about is developing a new class of drugs that would not block all the prostaglandins, but could selectively inhibit certain ones. It's a broad class, as I said, and the prostaglandin that we found that have the specific effect in the brain is not the same prostaglandin that causes premature labor.
Mm-hmm.
But the drugs that have been developed block the synthesis of all of them.
Is there any way you could test this out on people, this idea?
Well, yeah. I mean, we don't do experiments in humans, but we are going to try to find out secondarily. We have sort of two routes to do that. One is that there's been a longitudinal study going on in Great Britain called the Avon Longitudinal Parent and Child Study, and they have 15,000 women that they have very detailed records from during their pregnancies, and their children are now growing up and have also been assessed in a very detailed manner for a variety of endpoints, including the use of aspirin or other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories during pregnancy. And I have some collaborators in England that are going to start looking at various endpoints in the children, the oldest of which are about 13 right now, to see if there's any hint of any alterations in their views about sex, their thoughts mm-hmm. about sex, or any other endpoints. We don't know that in humans, where, you know, it's much more complex, there could be other mm-hmm. endpoints that are altered. The other thing is that there was a recent study in JAMA a couple months ago by a group in Italy that found that there's a naturally occurring variation in the enzyme that makes these prostaglandins in humans, in which there are some individuals that make a much lower level of the prostaglandins. And the purpose of that study was to look at risk for heart attack and stroke. And they found that individuals that make much lower levels of the prostaglandin are protected from heart attack and stroke. We might predict that those same individuals would have, the males of them would have a lower sex drive. So that's another sort of indirect way we could sort of get at finding out if this same mechanism is occurring in the human brain.
Let's go to the phones. Tony in Waterford. Hi, Tony.
Hi, I just wanted to ask your guest if there's been any study as to the relationship of prostaglandin blockage and the occurrence of homosexuality in males.
Well, certainly there hasn't, since this is the very first report of prostaglandins having any effect on the developing brain. And it's an obvious question to ask, because here we are talking about changing the sexual behavior of animals. But the way we designed the experiment did not address the question of who do you want to have sex with, right? So we didn't ask the animals, do you prefer males versus females as partners? There are some animal models that address that question, that give us some insight into the biological basis of homosexuality. But I would say what we know biologically about homosexuality is very, very limited, because it's a very complex behavior in a complex species, the human. What little we do know suggests that those mechanisms are different than the ones that we're tapping into, and that we think that our findings are pretty much restricted to libido rather than who you would like to have sex with.
All right, Tony, thanks.
Okay, thanks.
1-800-989-8255. Christine and Celine, hi.
Hi. I listen to you every Friday before I pick up my kids from school, and I cannot believe the obsession with men. And
my obsession?
Men's obsession. I can't believe this. I'm just like, Viagra, now aspirin. I'm like, anything else that women can do to demasculinize men? I find this hilarious. That maybe taking aspirin, you know, my kid can turn around in 6 years and say, Mom, now I got to take Viagra. I think this is hilarious that we're just focusing so much energy on this. Is this so important to men?
Oh, well, can I address that?
I hope so. I'm not addressing that.
Like, oh, my gosh.
Okay, so first of all, let me say I agree with the caller that it does seem that way. And I think, of course, you know, that people have been talking to me about lawsuits, and it's going to be the woman is going to sue her mother-in-law for the loss of conjugal rights because she took aspirin during pregnancy. But let me first say is that I did not engage in these studies in order to understand sex by men. Partly, we're and this research is actually funded by the National Institutes of Mental Health. They don't care about sex either. What we care about is how the brain develops in men and women. And when we use rats as an animal model, a very useful endpoint is sex behavior. So it's by it actually gives us a good hook into looking to the brain development between males and females. Why do we care about how the brain develops differently between males and females? Well, if we look at the whole cohort of neurological disorders and diseases and mental illnesses, while everybody's at risk of all of them, your relative risk does vary as a function of your sex. So boys are at much higher risks of disorders such as autism, dyslexia, stuttering, early onset schizophrenia, and attention deficit disorder. Women are at much higher risk of general depression and general anxiety disorders, feeding disorders, anxiety disorders, and obsessive compulsive. I say boys and women because the male bias disorders are largely developmental in origin, and they're sort of what we call disorders of wiring. The brain doesn't put itself together quite right. The female bias disorders are adult onset, postpubertal, and tend to be more disorders of neurochemistry. There's sort of an imbalance in the chemicals in the brain. That's why we do this research. Now, again, why males? Well, because the masculinization of the brain is an easy process to study because we know it's kicked off by testosterone. So we have the initial stimulus. The thing that my lab is focusing on right now is the development of the female brain, which is going to be much more intractable and much more difficult to get a handle on because it's the normal course of events is to develop a female brain.
All right. Christine, I'm going to thank you for your call. And keep listening, please.
No, I will.
Right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And we've run out of time, Dr. McCarthy. This is fascinating. We're going to have you back and talk more about this.
All right, great.
Thank you. Margaret McCarthy is professor of the Department of Physiology and Program in Neuroscience, University of Maryland in Baltimore. Thanks again. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the movie that opens today, that latest thriller, The Day After Tomorrow. How much science, how much fiction? Stay with us.